Hello and welcome to Crazy Talk Podcast. This is Angela Campagna. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Miss Maureen Skinner. Can you say hi, Maureen?
Hi, Maureen. Yes, my name is Maureen Skinner. I'm a licensed psychological examiner. I have a private practice here in Conway called Catalyst Counseling, and I get to work with Angela Campagna in our community to help people in all walks of life with all kinds of stuff going on. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm super excited about you joining us on these different episodes. And our Jason, my friend Jason, is decided to take a vacation. He's doing a little self-care, so we miss him. But hi, Jason. Hope you're having fun and taking care of yourself. And we have another special guest for you today. Her name is Miss Carly Potraz. She is a forensic interviewer for the Child Advocacy Alliance Group. Can you say hi, Carly, and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, everybody. Yes, so like she said, my name is Carly. I'm the forensic interviewer for the Children's Advocacy Alliance. I've lived in Conway for a long time. I love it. I'm so happy that I get to serve this community, and I'm so happy to be on the podcast with you guys.
Yay. We're so glad you're here.
Yeah.
So I want to jump right in. I want to know what a forensic interviewer is. Like, what does that mean?
Okay, so essentially when somebody calls the child abuse hotline for an allegation of abuse on a child, it gets assigned to an investigator, and then that investigator calls me, and we set up what's called a forensic interview, which just means an interview for the court, where essentially I get to interview the child about the alleged abuse that has occurred. So in short form, that's what a forensic interview is.
Carly, can you tell us, that seems like that is definitely a super important job. And yeah. I think it takes a very special person to do that. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of your training or how you feel you fit in that position?
Yeah, absolutely. So in order to forensic interview in the state of Arkansas, you have to be trained in something called Child First. And so essentially you learn how to be a neutral, unbiased party and to interview the children. And so you have to start off with that training. And then I also have to have continued education every year because it's important to update and stay relevant with all the topics on child abuse, obviously. And it does take a special person, and there is kind of an art to it. And a lot of people think it's really tough and really hard, and it is. But then, you know, I have my days where I just feel like I was absolutely built to do this, because it's important to have enough empathy to care for what the children are saying to you, but not so much empathy in the room that you can't continue doing what you're doing in a good way. So
what about... Sorry to interrupt. What about your educational background? If somebody wanted to become a forensic interviewer, do they need a bachelor's degree or a master's degree or a high school diploma?
Right. So I have a bachelor's degree in sociology, and that's kind of what they like to have, is either a bachelor's degree in sociology or psychology or some type of social service. So that's kind of, for at least for my center, that's what's required. And I think that that's a good starting point for anybody who would like to do interviewing, so that you learn about kind of the inequities that children face and how to be objective.
Nice.
I also love that you brought up you have to have the right amount of empathy in the room, because Maureen and I
balance.
Both. Oh, yeah. Maureen and I both work with trauma a lot, right? And we also, neither one of us work with children.
Interesting. See, I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I really did think that I wanted to work with children first when I decided to become a therapist. That's where I thought I was going to go. But because of the things that you interview children about, I have... When I was in school, I had a small child at the time, and I already knew that I could not at any point keep the empathy at a correct level, because it's, you know, all children were my baby kind of thing. Right. It was really, yeah. So the fact that you do that is even more impressive.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
That happened to me too, actually, Maureen. When I started grad school, I wanted to major in families and children. And then in my first internship, I dealt with the families and children, probably something that Carly would work with, where the child had been removed from the home. And after a month of that, I switched my major.
Yeah.
It was just too much. Yeah. So I think we can learn a lot from you today, Carly, about how you manage that. what your organization does?
Yeah.
Well, and that was my next question is CASA, the Children's Advocacy Alliance. What area do you serve? Are you just Central Arkansas or is it all of Arkansas?
So we're broken up, CACs and CASA are broken up into regions. So we serve like Faulkner County, Perry County, Conway County, Van Buren County, and Searcy County between the two organizations. So it's a nice little chunk of Arkansas. A lot of it is rural. So I would say that our biggest county we serve is obviously Faulkner County, and that's where the majority of our cases come from. But yeah, we're pretty far reaching in terms of the state.
Obviously, you work with probably the prosecuting attorney's office quite closely.
Yes. So, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say one of my most favorite things that I learned about the prosecuting attorney's office is that they have an emotional support therapy dog named Barb that sits with the kids when they're in court.
Yes.
Every time I think about Barb, I cry. She has her own cards and everything. Like, she's the coolest.
She is the coolest. And we're actually really excited because we're applying for a facility dog. So we'll have somebody who's like Barb that'll be able to sit in on forensic interviews, trauma-focused therapy, medical exams, and we cannot wait. We're so excited.
That's so amazing. When I talked with the prosecuting attorney's office, they said a lot of cases got pled out because Barb was there and was so supportive for the kids that they could testify and the perpetrators would back down and plea out.
Oh, yeah. Every time a kid comes to the center, they always take one of the little Barb cards. Everybody I know is obsessed with Barb.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
What I'm getting already is it looks like your organization really stays on top of trying to get the most sort of evidence-based and good, like you mentioned, trauma-focused therapy, but also some more modern good things, even so, like this pet therapy, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's a big deal. We're very excited. We try to keep up with the times as much as we can, especially our trauma-focused therapist. She always tries to keep up with the modern and the new and different treatment plans. And so I'm really grateful to be able to work with her for sure.
I was just thinking about the prosecuting attorney's office here. They were the first of its kind to have a therapy dog or a support, emotional support animal in the courtroom, kind of a jumping off place. They have, because these animals provide that kind of emotional support, the continuity, if they started with y'all during a forensic interview and then there is court, like every piece of that along the way is a supportive item for them. That's just amazing that you can do this for them.
Yeah, and we actually have a office cat and he's kind of more for the staff. We love him so much and he's a great way to kind of relieve stress. And then we actually have a therapy assisted animal. She's a little kitten. She comes to work every day with our therapist. And so we love using animals with kids because it's a great resource, because who doesn't love kittens and puppies and, you know, stuff like that. So we're really lucky.
What about in the time of COVID-19? Like what has changed in your job and like, I mean, that's got to be huge. I know our jobs have been just like upended.
Right. So for a while there, we kind of dipped down because obviously it's therapists and educators who are making the bulk of reports to the child abuse hotline. So we know that pretty soon, whenever, you know, life starts to kind of get back to normal, that the cases are definitely going to spike up just because, you know, the kids are home alone with the people who might be abusing them right now. So that's been one major thing. We've been screening everybody who comes to the center because it's important to keep providing services to these families. We always like to say that child abuse it's not an 8-to-5 job and we have to make it work because they're our priority. So if we have to wear masks, we do. We've been kind of looking at telehealth forensic interviewing. That's something we've been looking into. So it's all kind of unprecedented. And we're just trying to keep up with what's best for the kids right now, but it's definitely been a transition. How has it been for you guys with adults with COVID?
Mostly it's lots of this type of interaction. It was a fairly seamless transition for me. I was already trained to do distance work. So it's not my favorite, but I'm so grateful that I get to continue to do it. That it's like this, it's, there's the lag and the, you'll have to wait and take turns and you repeat yourself. And so it's exhausting in that fashion, yeah. But the fact that it's an option is just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with Maureen on that one because I've done telehealth before. I think the big thing is most of us would have taken advantage of this before, but insurance companies wouldn't cover it. But now they are, you know, because I have other people that have mobility problems or different things like that. It literally is hard for them to get to their appointments. So this has opened up some cool options for us, I feel like. And, you know, I think it's good. We talk about health, and I think probably Maureen is the same. We always talk to our clients about health and fevers and things like that in general, and things in the world that might be causing more stress, right, Maureen?
Absolutely. Of interesting note, most of my really anxious folks are not struggling very much because the bad thing that they've all been anticipating is happening. So they're kind of, you know, they're like, well, we were right.
Yeah, and a lot of them too, I've seen this, they can be more introverted, and so they kind of enjoy not having to go out more. But I have seen people with sort of low-level anxiety that have never been in therapy, but now it's like a little bit too much, and they don't have their normal coping skills. Like that, they have their internal ones, but you know they can't go to the gym. I guess they can now. They can't go see ones that they care about. It's just been a really interesting time. But I'm super glad that you did decide to come on, Carly, because I think Maureen knows a lot about this already. And I think that honestly, we all should in our community understand this process because our children need us. And can you tell us a little bit about sort of what would be the normal reason that, or not normal, because it's not normal, right? But the average reason of why your organization becomes involved?
So the majority of our cases are sexual abuse cases for the Children's Advocacy Center. Now, most children who are taken into care for foster care, I believe is more kind of neglect reasons, but they definitely still deal with sexual abuse and physical abuse. So just to give a little bit of background on the actual agency, it is an umbrella agency. So we have CASA, which is Court Appointed Special Advocates, and then the Children's Advocacy Center. And those two together make up the alliance. So the advocates, anytime a kid comes into foster care, they're assigned an advocate. And that advocate basically meets with all of the pillars in the child's life to make sure that the well-being of the child is the number one priority of the courts. So they stick with the child throughout the entirety of the case and are really just there as their person throughout all of it. And then at the CAC, we provide medical exams, trauma-focused therapy, advocacy, and forensic interviews. So all combined, it's all kinds of different abuse, to be honest with you, but the majority is sexual abuse that we serve. So
the advocate is like the Lorax, and they yes. speak to the children.
Yes, the advocate is there to do all and everything. Everything for the well-being of the child. And that's what the advocate does at the center as well. They're really there for resources and resource allocation to make sure that the families are okay.
So, Carly, you did bring up, though, neglect. Could you help our listeners kind of see what neglect looks like? Like what your agency would consider neglect, if that makes sense.
Right, absolutely. So there's a lot of, I think when people picture neglect, they picture the horrible cases that happen on the news where it's like a child trapped and has no food or water or anything. But it can be all kinds of different neglect. So even something called educational neglect. So I would say if a parent's not taking the child to school, that's, you know, considered neglect. Say if the parent isn't providing food and making the child prep all the food and take care of the baby and take care of the family, that's a form of neglect. So even things that we wouldn't think of like the big horrible news stories, they are considered neglect because kids can't do it on their own. They have to have their parents there. And if the parents aren't helping, then that's something that we would consider neglect for sure.
Do you participate, does your agency participate in reunification type stuff?
So that's definitely more of the CASA side with the advocates and the supervisors, but for sure. I think reunification is always the goal if that can happen. They want to try everything they can and all the avenues they can to make sure that the parents and the children can be back together if it's appropriate. And then obviously if it's not appropriate, that's a whole other kind of can of worms of, you know, the foster care system and getting them adopted and things like that. But the advocates are truly wonderful when these kids have literally no one in their life. You know, the advocate is there to check on them at least once a month, but they always check on them more than that. And they're really just a pillar in the child's life. But definitely reunification is a number one goal.
So Carly, this may not be your department, but I'm kind of curious about this. Absolutely. Other states that I've worked in, there was a lot of, with the unification, very structured things and the plan that the parents had to complete, you know, parenting course, you know, drug testing, whatever. Is there something like that that you guys work with, or how does that work here?
So you were a little bit right in that it's not completely my department, but I do know that there are very stringent things that the parents have to go through. Every child has a caseworker, and that caseworker is obviously in charge of making sure that the parents are doing right, the child's doing okay, all court, everything is taken care of, and really just manages the entire case. So there definitely are things in place to make sure that the parents are actually doing right and can have the child back. I'm not sure on the specifics, but I do know that they exist for sure.
Yeah, it's probably case to case basis, I guess. Or Maureen, do you know more about that?
I honestly don't. Social workers tend to be way more involved in that part of the field, like almost exclusively. I also, like Angela, don't work with children, so it really doesn't ever get in my orbit very much. Right. But I do know that there are case by case basis, but there's also like a very specific set of like must comply with that everybody is going to have to be able to pass.
Right. And it really does depend on the allegation. Like, say if you have sexual abuse allegations, that's going to be totally treated differently than educational neglect. Because if DHS can get involved and say, hey, you have to bring your child to school, and they actually make sure that the children do go to school, well, then reunification might happen, and certain rules might happen. But then when you have sexual abuse, you know, that's a totally different game, and it's a lot harder to overcome than just something like, you know, educational neglect.
Okay, Carly. Yeah. So, you know, we talked about the neglect.
Yeah.
Sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Do you care to tell us a little bit about what that looks like, or what you guys look out for, or just let's go there. Go ahead, Maureen.
Yeah. Even like maybe more to the point is what can we look out for? What are ways that children hide sexual abuse like that? I know that there are some common themes that occur, and so maybe like that would be super helpful for us to know how to look for it.
Right. So a big thing is grooming, and that's something that I didn't know a lot before I started this job. But you know, when you start noticing, hey, this family member keeps offering, you know, my niece to go alone and play with ponies, or, you know, you just kind of start noticing like, hey, this child is getting special treatment. That's something always to watch out for sure. Sexual abuse, something I'm very passionate about is like, we have to teach our kids appropriate names for their body parts, because that's something that we've run into, and we've all heard the story of the kid who said, hey, my uncle took my cookie or licked my cookie. And it's like, the teacher doesn't understand what the cookie means. And so that's something I'm really passionate about. But just listen to the children that you talk to, support the kids that we talk to. A lot of times it's kind of like, oh, there's no way that could have happened. I know him, and you know, he would never do anything like that. But you know, these are just normal people who are offending on kids. And so you have to be receptive if a child is trying to tell you like, hey, something's not right here, something's, you know, off. And always check in with kids. Hey, has anybody ever touched your body in a way that wasn't okay with you? Has anybody ever tried to make you touch their body in a way that wasn't okay with you? And I think just having open dialogue and watching out for signs like that is really one of the best ways you can kind of go with it. So
we have a lot of conversations about consent. Like that's a big
yes.
one.
Yes.
As a mother, I've never forced my children to hug anybody they didn't want to hug.
That's a huge one.
So common that there are loads of parents and grandparents that will insist, and we are teaching our children that they do not have bodily autonomy. And so they are way more susceptible to being inappropriately touched by people that have nefarious motives.
Absolutely. Or like, okay, well, you can't have this cookie until you go hug your uncle. And it's like, why would we make, you know, why would we do that whenever, you know, sexual abuse is such a common thing that people don't necessarily want to talk about, but it's happening. And so we need to talk about it.
It is something difficult to talk about. I think that's part of it. And I think we do have just, like every other state, some lack of education with people in the community.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, I've been processing this a lot lately, and that's why I wanted to talk with you guys. I've really just been feeling so sad about so many kids, especially being home right now without the teachers and the school meals and all that. And I do think we just have a lot of lack of education, you know, and them just doing what their parents did, et cetera, et cetera. And then, like Maureen and I, we've had a lot of education on this. And actually, the both of us, we're probably those type of people that were just born this way to sort of look out for the bad and, you know, but.
Be hyper vigilant.
Yeah. You've been here. I was away for a while and I came back. So I'm kind of just adjusting back to here. But Maureen, you've been here the whole time. Would you say that, like, sort of parenting education is a problem, or what do you think about that?
I wouldn't call it a problem per se, but it is. We don't have sex education in the schools. It's a very hot political topic, and mostly they're like health only, and we're not going to talk about sex, and we're not going to talk about normal or natural or expected or even any of the other possibilities. There's really a lot of pressure to not put that in our schools because it's kind of taboo, and you know, there's this ridiculous belief that if you talk about sex, you will have sex. And what we know is that they're going to have sex.
It's true.
Period. Whether you talk about it or not.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of like, I mean, that we've talked about suicide. We know now that, you know, it's better to ask and better to talk, have that conversation, but we still have that, you know, I think the average person does, that hesitant of to bringing it up. And I feel sex is one of those. Totally. And I think it's, each family has such a different perspective on it. You know, if, you know, you brought this up in some other things, Maureen, I think if every parent did the quote right thing and educated their child with the proper terminology and didn't force them to hug people, then, you know, it would be a perfect world. But we've talked about that before. As humans in general, we don't always do the right thing, especially when it's uncomfortable to us.
Or inconvenient, even in some cases.
Totally. Yeah.
We're really lucky. We actually have an education and prevention specialist. So she's been around for a little while, but she's been kind of getting herself into schools. And so she actually goes around to daycares and schools and teaches kids about body safety and having people that they can trust and, you know, not keeping secrets. And so we're really excited to see how that plays out, especially in the Conway community, because there are so many kids in Conway. It's definitely an issue that we've been trying to focus on for sure.
Maureen. Do you have something?
We need a method to establish who's going to talk. It's like playing volleyball. We're both going to miss the ball. We're going to let it fall.
I know. We both get all these great ideas.
I was just thinking about the way that we respond to trauma, and you know, trauma is trauma. We all tend to have sort of a similar human experience to it. The shutting down, you know, the dissociative thing that happens, and children in particular, they might just get quiet and a lot more well-behaved if they're being abused, which is, you know, that doesn't ever sound like a bad sign. Oh, where she's just so quiet and good.
Right. Absolutely. And then on the flip side of that, I feel like kids are so much more resilient sometimes than we give, than other people give them credit for. Like, there's kids in interviews where it's like, you know, they talk about things that I could never imagine happening. And then at the end, they're like, I'm going to McDonald's, you know, and they're so excited. And so I just think if we can respond with proper therapy and proper trauma-focused therapy in particular, then we, these kids are so resilient on their own that I think in the combination with that, we could really make some good changes. And so that's why I love that we do have a trauma-focused therapist on site. And she does things like girls group and, you know, stuff like that. She's wonderful.
Well, and that's,
I'm thinking,
that's what I was going to ask.
He did it again.
Your website, Hope and Justice, it says yes. That there's volunteer opportunities. Is that, can, how do we become an advocate, for instance?
So there's advocate trainings. There's a section online on the hopeandjustice.org specifically for volunteers. And you're always more than welcome to just Google Children's Advocacy Alliance and give us a call, and we will get you in touch with the right people, because we're always recruiting volunteers, whether it's for Heroes for Hope race that we do, or Festival of Chairs, one of our biggest fundraisers, and becoming an advocate. There's always advocate training happening. And so, you know, I always encourage people to check out the website, give us a call, and come tour. Anybody is welcome to come tour the center and see what we do and talk about CASA and talk about the CAC and how to get involved and how to donate and things like that. So I'm definitely a big advocate for doing that.
All right, Angela, it's your turn.
That's a So I might back up a little bit. I have like two things going on in my mind right now. Because I'm looking at, you know, Maury and I don't work with children, right? And I can see where you do, and children can be so resilient. And I'm glad that they're getting therapy, like they definitely need therapy if any neglect or any trauma has happened. Because if they don't, then they usually end up seeing Maureen and I, you know, to where they're processing things that happened in childhood that they sort of were in denial about, or they disassociated, or they didn't really have that chance to process. So I think it can be, like what we were saying, a little bit tricky. Like Maureen said, oh, but they're being very quiet and good. You know, they can look like they're being resilient and fine, but inside they're internalizing and disassociating in very, very terrible turmoil.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, and that's what global. Oops, sorry. Our little yellow boxes aren't showing up fast enough. Go, Carly.
You're fine. Well, I was going to ask you guys, like, if somebody comes in and you can tell that they have a lot of childhood trauma, this is a really vague question, but how do you even go about that when you have 40 years of just like trauma and just all these things happening? How do you even start to unravel that?
Awesome. I'll let you go first, Maureen. Let's both go. Let's both talk about that one. Okay.
Let's both talk. Absolutely. So it's not a forensic interview because it's not for the court, but it is a clinical interview. And we talk about, you know, we get data, childhood, like we're developmental stuff and any kind of issues with school. And I always ask about trauma. Regularly people say no. And then 30 minutes later say, well, you know, I was raped when I was 14. And so they have completely compartmentalized that into this other thing that they're fine from.
Right.
So that, you know, that is just one of the many ways that we discovered that there's trauma that people are, you know, not dealing with, that they've stuffed down somewhere and left.
Goodness.
And I do a very similar interview. It's like you said, it's not an interview. It's a clinical sort of discussion to get to know the individual. And I'm like, experienced sort of the same thing with Maureen. Sometimes people, to me, they don't even know that they've been traumatized, okay? You know, and I'll do that screening for, you know, any traumatic, you know, childhood thing, high school, and they're like, no. And I'm like, okay, so no bullying, no beatings, no this, no that. And they're like, yeah. Then they say, well, all these things happened. You know, I was severely bullied. I was beaten. Oh, yeah, my father died by suicide, but I'm totally fine. But you're in the chair here and you're having panic attacks. So then we go into, then I ask, like, how do you sleep? How's your appetite? Then it's like all the PTSD symptoms start pouring out of them. And then that's when we do, I usually do a lot of education. Maureen, how do you usually go about that? I usually start with that.
I try to get some good data, like use the ACE score, the Adverse Childhood Experiences. It's a questionnaire that, you know, a score on, of three or more on the ACE exam, you know, indicates enough trauma to qualify for at least therapy. And I think everybody could benefit from counseling or therapy. But yeah, I try to do some objective testing just to add that to the robustness of my diagnosis, if there is a trauma diagnosis. And yeah, it's just like, it's lots of really good questions, just probably like you do.
Yeah, I think this is kind of cool. We can explain a little bit because Maureen is a psychologist, psychological examiner, right?
Yeah.
So she's got that skill in doing a lot more of those sort of assessments. Mm-hmm. Assessments, yeah. And I do things a little bit differently. I sort of ask about things like, where do you feel this in your body? I'm sure she does that too. But I go through more of sort of like a conversation of your sleep pattern, your appetite, your anger, you know, it's just a little bit of a different approach. And I think we probably mix both of them together. But I do a lot of, you know, where do you feel this in your body? I'm sure you do that too, Maureen. But I think it's just, oh, yeah, we both kind of probably start with a little bit different perspective. But I think our interventions are the same, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is really like mostly what I do with the data that I'm collecting is, because I'm a psych examiner, we use these objective testing measures to support a diagnosis. There is no test, one single test for anything. It's mm-hmm. It's just some data points to support the diagnosis if any insurance company or some, you know, disability service needed an evaluation. It's just for me to say, yes, look, I asked these questions also. It's people with a significant trauma history tend to have a series of behaviors that are really common. They really hate traffic and they really don't like it when people don't do what they say they're going to do. Like they have a really intense sort of response to people not being accountable. They tend to have a really strong sense of justice and are really irritated when things aren't fair. They tend to be early or be like never be on time, one or the other. But they tend to be control freaks, or people think people will say, well, you're just a control freak, when in fact they're just trying to have some kind of semblance of control in their chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I'm learning so much from you guys.
Well, yeah, I think we're learning from you too. And I think that's the cool thing about these podcasts and episodes. And, you know, we are all Zooming for the listeners, but we don't script this. You know, we try to pick a topic and we sort of let this flow organically. And I think that's a great way for people to learn from all of us.
Well, and I probably wouldn't be able to stay on script anyway. You can't trust me for a second.
I know, but this is why these conversations don't happen enough, is they're so complex. You know, you can't just describe trauma in a paragraph, and you definitely can't describe that intervention in a paragraph. You know, it's dynamic, wouldn't you say, Maureen and Carly, because you're very similar. Yep. You do the interviews. I think it's very dynamic, right?
100%. There's so many complexities, and it's so multifaceted, 100%.
So it's really a lot of thinking on your feet and paying really close attention to nonverbal cues and all of those other things, you know, the holistic approach of like the data collection of an ACE study, but also the questions that you're asking and your observations that you're noticing and other history and medical reports of broken bone. Like it's a huge undertaking where you get as much information as you can, because you do not want to make a forensic claim that is inaccurate.
Yeah, 100%. That's something that we've been really trying to focus on is, and I don't know the acronym breakdown as well as I used to, but the CAT score. I don't know if you guys are familiar with with that, we give every single child that comes in, we give them a CAT score. Every single child, we try to refer for therapy. So we're trying our hardest, but it's definitely, there's so many stigmas, I think, still around mental health. Like, I always get surprised when parents feel like therapy isn't appropriate for their child, because I think therapy is appropriate for literally everyone. So it's something we're definitely trying to work on, for sure.
Well, I think
such a stigma.
One of the benefits of this global, our response to the global pandemic and being under quarantine and stepping into televideo as a means of providing services, is the stigma seems to be lessening. Like, people are talking about therapy or telehealth or whatever in a very casual fashion now. They're like, oh yeah, I got to meet my therapist, or I have an appointment. You know, this has, I think, helped significantly reducing the stigma of, you know, oh, you have a therapist.
Yeah. I love the focus on mental health lately, and that there's been so many, even on social media, it's like, I feel like all of my posts are surrounded about, like, take care of your mental, you know, take care of yourself. And so I think you're right. 100%. I agree.
Right. And it is Mental Health Awareness Month, and that, you know, that's what we're trying to do with this podcast, is break that stigma. And there are a lot of people in our community, like you, Carly, and your organization, that are supporting our mental health and, like, our children and different areas that people just don't see. You know, it's just not, you get this, especially if you start getting a call with DHS or something involved, there's very derogatory stigma around that. But the whole concept is really to support the mental health and the well-being, right?
Yep, everything. And that's, you know, my protocol, Child First, is exactly that. It's always the child first. It's always the well-being of the child. And I feel like, as a center, and for CASA as well, that's always everybody's top goal, is the priority, or that's our priority, is the well-being of the child. And so I think everybody always advocates for mental health. And I think some of our partner agencies a lot are kind of like, oh, therapy, yeah, therapy. But it's like, let's dig into therapy. Let's dig into how good therapy is and what it does and what it looks like and, you know, how it changes things. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to help educate, I guess, and to be educated by you two.
I have a personal experience with the system, as it were. We got put on a FINS petition, Families in Need of Services. For fourth grade, my daughter and I went to Indonesia, and we were overseas for the first 2 weeks of fourth grade, which put us very close to the edge of having too many absences. And then there were a couple of, like, late or picked up early things that happened, which pushed us over the edge. And we ended up with a case with DHS, where I had to report weekly and make sure that she was at school every time. This is a straight A student who has never been in trouble ever. You know, I am not a person who has been involved with, you know, the legal system in any way, but they were looking out for my kid. She'd missed enough school for that. And they didn't really do a case by case basis, or they probably wouldn't have put that on us, because we weren't necessarily in need of services. Yeah. But that's, you know, that's why they count truancy or absences from school, is because of that neglect piece.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I will say, just, you know, to be honest and fair, I don't know, this is not about CASA, but just in general, our policies and laws around this don't always make sense. Is that fair to say? Like, sometimes they just don't make sense.
Sometimes they, yeah, absolutely do not make sense. And it's frustrating to be on this side of things sometimes, because I just want to scream and tell people, like, don't you get it? Like, don't you see? So yeah, I think there's a lot of times that what we want and what is true don't align, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like Angela made the point, it's not children first in a lot of legislation. It is money first, or
yep,
somebody's good favor, or, you know, any number of things. We've very much gotten away from serving the people in our communities.
Yeah, I think it's like, it starts, you know, institutionally, and then it trickles all the way down to the fact that there's so many agencies are so understaffed that it's like, how can you expect for them to, you know, consistently do quality jobs when there's only, you know, 3 caseworkers? So I think it starts at the top and trickles all the way down, and it does affect the kids in the community, affects everybody in the community. So I would love to see more support for legislation that is child first.
I wonder, you know, who, I know who the senators are, I know who the state reps are, but like, I wonder who we would be reaching out to encourage that. Is CASA a lobbyist? Do they have a lobby?
Well, fun fact, Susan Hutchinson, the first lady, is actually a big proponent of working with child abuse victims. So that's she's right. Come and she's toured the center. And obviously there's a tie there to CASA, but she's definitely a big proponent of trying to get legislation going in favor of what we do. So she's a big one to kind of reach out to, write letters to, things like that.
Yeah, she spoke at this last Festival of the Chairs, and yes. She really focused on trauma-informed care and trauma in very, very early childhood. I was very impressed with that. And I have other colleagues and lobbyists and politician friends of mine that have told me, and these are educated, professional people, that they had never heard of trauma-informed care until they heard about it from her.
Oh, goodness.
Wow. Yeah. So I think she's trying, but we all have to really, really keep doing these things, keep podcasting, keep pushing forward.
Public awareness.
Keep talking about it.
Yeah. For sure.
That's the thing.
Education.
Yep.
Yeah. So how are you feeling, Carly? Is there anything that, you know, you had on your mind that you really wanted to chat with in this episode or?
Well, I actually had a question for you guys on self-care. I feel like that's something we talk about kind of all the time. And I just feel like at work, we do self-care, but not in an appropriate way. Like, we should be doing more. And so I just, from you guys' opinions, like, what are the best ways to do self-care when you work in these kind of fields?
So I'm kind of, before we go into that, can she tell us what are the ones that she considers inappropriate or not good? Unhealthy, yeah, yeah. What are those? What do you think is unhealthy coping?
I just
self-care,
feel like,
sorry.
I feel like it's hard to have boundaries when you're doing this job because, like I said earlier, child abuse is not 8 to 5. So oftentimes I feel like even when I'm home, I'm working, I'm not having that transition of going from home, you know, to work and from work to home. And so it just kind of all turns into this gray kind of blah mess. And I don't know how to separate as well, I feel like. And just, you know, stuff like that I just feel like this cannot be the right way of doing this.
You are correct. 100%. Yeah. That is a not excellent way of doing that. It is a way of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The separation piece, having really good boundaries is probably the best thing I've ever done for myself. Like, I stop responding to phone calls. I stop responding to emails within about an hour of getting home, just so I can be home. I have some transition kind of, not rituals per se, but like habits where I get home and I get a coffee or a glass of wine or something and go walk in my yard and look at my flowers and literally like work on decompressing.
Yeah.
Leave work at work. And it's so hard for us because we are empathic. We do this because we care. And so it's really hard when somebody's having a hard time to get, you know, not carry that all around.
So I'm totally on board with Maureen with that, and I do something similar. And I really suggest to people especially when they're in high stress jobs like this, you do need to prepare a transition to enter the home and the relaxation. Just like you need to start giving your body signals before bed to go to sleep, you need to do that to transition to home. So I have some people that I work with that I suggest you can sit in the car for 5 minutes and do a guided meditation or listen to a relaxing song and kind of switch your body and your mind that now I'm in the moment. Mindfulness is a big key. Now I'm in my house. It smells like lavender, you know, it smells like coffee or hot chocolate. Yes. Because we're using those senses, right, Maureen? Sight, sound, smell to help us prepare. And there's one other big thing, Carly. I cannot believe I didn't bring this up yet. Vicarious trauma. Are you familiar with this?
Yes. I need to be educated more, but yes, I'm slowly getting into the world of vicarious trauma.
You're living in the world of vicarious trauma.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So in other places I've worked, I've sort of, in crisis care, I taught some little mini classes for our people about vicarious trauma. And all those things that Maureen and I were just talking about, mindfulness, having that cup of coffee, doing all that, that is the only way to combat it, you know? Yeah. Those boundaries and doing those things for yourself. And especially for
intentional. Like it's yes. really important to think about it. Like I am doing this because, and it is good mm-hmm. for me, and it is an intentional practice. So that, you know, it's like brushing your teeth. You don't just brush them once.
Right.
I mean, you can.
And I really find, especially in our line of work, like you have to schedule it,
yeah.
you know, it's,
yeah,
it's
I have a mark on my calendar that says you, because you don't just work to die. And I have a section blocked out.
Yeah. I think that's what's been so kind of hard about this, you know, quarantine is the lack of transitions of, okay, mm-hmm. I've been working in my house and now it's time to decompress, but I'm still kind of in that awkward mind space. And I think that's probably been a big challenge for everyone. So I appreciate some of that feedback for sure.
I definitely think you're right that this is my office. I'm actually coming up to my office to work, even though I'm just here by myself, because the transition is so important to me. Yeah. I feel more professional. I feel more accomplished. It's more private. It's, you know, I'm not restricting the movement of the people in my house because I'm in the back room going, shh, be quiet, you know.
Yes, if you have that opportunity, I do the same, Maureen. But I think if you're at home, you could set up a little space or, you know,
go outside.
Go outside, take a bath, you know, lock yourself in a closet for a few minutes away from your children, whatever works.
Get
creative.
There are two rules. Don't hurt yourself and don't hurt anybody else. However else you're doing it is fine. You can drink yourself into a stupor, but follow rule one. Don't hurt yourself. So like, you know, that's it.
That's what I wanted. That's where I was going when she said, you know, the sort of unhealthy coping, because it gets really tricky. If you do anything, you know, eating chocolate can become unhealthy, but it can also be a super way to get through this. You know what I mean?
Well, and a super way to be really present, like have a piece of chocolate and experience the chocolate and sit in your car before you go into the house. Like you could leave the house, go sit in your car, have your moment and go back in. If you're working from home, you know, create transition things.
I like that you said you have to be intentional and be present, because mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's like it happens to you and you don't even realize it happened to you. I know for the first 6 months, I started kind of experiencing, I think, kind of burnout symptoms. And I just didn't realize that that was what was happening. And then as soon as I got some education, it was like, whoa, I think I'm a little bit burnt out, you know, and it just happened without even knowing it.
There's a name for that. It's called compassion fatigue.
Okay.
And it is, it will just wear you out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It drains you completely. And if you cannot pour from an empty cup. And so your recharge at home is essential for you. Right. You know, if you're going to take good care of yourself so that you can be present for those kids, like that's how this works. And
right.
compassion fatigue is super real and it is hardcore.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of that. You have to take care of yourself if you want to take care of others, for sure.
And honestly, I think we all need to probably, you know, be more talkative and open up about that too, because a lot of people don't want to admit that they are getting compassion fatigue or that they're struggling. Mm-hmm. But it happens to all of us. And I'm sure it's even happening more so right now to our nurses, our police officers, all our first responders, mm-hmm. you know, for real.
Well, and I've been listening to The Body Keeps the Score by Besser Vendel, whatever his name is. He's got that wonderful.
I'm reading that right now. Yeah.
Okay. So they're talking about, though, is that just how these things impact us long term, and that when we are traumatized, it sort of shuts us off just a little bit. And maybe some people are dealing really well by they're just fine. You know, they're going to go to McDonald's or whatever. Like, yeah, that happened, and haha, that was weird, huh? And then they've disclosed some kind of incredibly heavy, terrible thing. It's our brain protecting us. It's like you're not ready to deal with that right now, so we're just going to let you look at it as if it's sort of a movie happening to somebody else, and you don't have to feel those things because you can't. It's too much.
Oh yeah. I definitely have kids where it's like they tell this incredible story and it's like it's happening to somebody else. when it's like it was happening to you, but it's like, you know, they use dolls or they use whatever to say, hey, look, it's not me, it's happening over here.
That's compartmentalizing, and it is a super effective tool so that you can survive. I mean, that's what I think of PTSD is this, it is your brain protecting you. It is absolutely going into lockdown and giving you these things to do that make you feel safe. Mostly, you know, those habits can get in the way, but it is, you know, post-traumatic stress. I don't think it should be called a disorder. I think it should be called a syndrome, because it's as a result of really extreme things that have happened. And, you know, this post-traumatic stress is your brain going, okay, really bad things happen to you, so you don't have to feel all of that right now, or you don't have to think about all of that right now. We'll just, your memory is going to be really fuzzy.
Yeah.
Well, Carly, thank you so much for joining us. This has been, I really feel like our listeners have heard a lot of different stuff. I never know, like I said, we don't script this, but I think a lot of good topics came up. We spoke about your organization and the awesome things they're doing. We learned about what you do with your job and other supports, but we also talked a lot about trauma. Yeah. Surprise, surprise. Mental health awareness month, we're talking about trauma. And ways to combat that and self-care. Maureen, did you have anything you wanted to say to our listeners before we sort of wind down?
Mostly that this kind of collaboration between groups like therapists and advocates and attorneys and the police and doctors, like this, it really does take a village for us to do this and support our community and our kids. And so I'm having gotten to meet you today, Carly, and I'm super grateful that you're out there as one of the first people that these children meet and have to talk about some of the most awful things they've experienced. So, like, thank you for what you do. That's amazing.
You're a superhero, Carly.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for what you do. I think we're all doing really good, really good things. I appreciate you guys.
Awesome. Real quick before we sign off, can you tell us how to access to volunteer? Can you also donate money through that site? It's the hopeandjustice.org, is that right?
Yes, so it's hopeandjustice.org, and we are a nonprofit, so we are always, you know, needing donations for sure, especially right now because things are just, you know, so unknown. But definitely visit the website. Definitely give us a call. Come by and tour and see what we do, and, you know, we can come up with creative ways of giving and volunteering and things like that on an individual basis, for sure.
They also, for the Festival of Chairs, you can donate items or things like that that they auction off.
Yes, and that's coming up. It's comes up quicker than we think every year, but it's in October. It's our biggest fundraising event. Unfortunately, our smaller fundraising event got changed because of COVID, but we're hoping that Festival of Chairs is big this year and we get a lot of donations. And so definitely check the website out and get to know more about us.
Yes, that is an awesome event. I went this last year. There's a lot of great artists and it's a really fun night. So definitely something that our listeners should check out. So great discussion, ladies. Yeah.
And follow our Facebook page, the Children's Advocacy Alliance. That's where all the good stuff is, I promise.
Children's Advocacy on Facebook, is that what it's called?
Yes.
Advocacy Alliance.
Yes.
Okay, awesome, Carly. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, listeners, for all your support. We couldn't keep doing this without you, and we hope that you learned some great stuff today. See you soon.